It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, a museum without walls where artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And today we're going to have a conversation that focuses on the aesthetics and science of food, including how to improve taste, nutrition, health through art and science, what in the world is food science? Food science program coordinators, are here with us, as well as food science teachers and food scientists and chefs. And somehow we'll figure out how that is working for all three of these. But I wanted to welcome Andrea Lysiega, who's the Associate Professor of Food Science at Purdue. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Mark. Hello, everyone. Nice to be here with you again.
You too. And I've got Brendan Chandler, who's a science teacher at Orchard School and maybe not known to everybody. It's also a chef, studied chef school, culinary school. Welcome, yeah. Brendan.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
And I've got Allie Kingery, who's the food science program coordinator and also a chef at Purdue University. Hi, Allie.
Hi, thank you for including me today.
You're so welcome. So I guess the best way to first start is one of you can tackle this from the Purdue side. What is food science?
Okay, I guess that's me. I saw Ali pointing at it. All right, well, food science, I would define as it's a multidiscipline. We use the science of biology, the science of chemistry, the science of even engineering, to look at how we can go basically from farm to fork, right? Or from the farm, the agriculture production, all the way to harvesting, processing, and making the food in a way that it's acceptable to consumers, but most importantly, that it's safe to consume as well. So it's multidisciplinary, combines a lot of different disciplines that together allows us to study to look at how we can make our food available, shelf stable, and obviously safe and delicious.
And so what's really important, I think, to point out is that what you're talking about is that it is really research and science that you're doing, not market research or that, although that may come into it a little bit, but it's more on really... You use science processes,
yes,
as you said, to be able to get there. And so exactly. That's different than people may be aware of. You know, that companies employ other people to get their product out, but this is different.
Exactly. Yeah. So food marketing could be a small branch of within food science, right? How can we market this food products or this science to consumers? But yeah, it's definitely a small branch, but the core are the main disciplines, the main scientific disciplines, your chemistry, your biology, your microbiology, engineering, all combined together within food.
Wow.
And then I don't know if Ali wants to add something to that.
Yeah, sure. As undergraduates, we want to make sure that all of our students understand how those concepts all play together. When our students graduate, they may decide to go straight into industry where they are focusing on one specific area. They may do sensory science, or they may do flavor chemistry or packaging, or they may be the food scientist at a small company and be responsible for meshing all of those components together. If our students decide to continue on for a graduate education, they're likely to focus a little bit more on one of those areas: food chemistry, food processing, food safety, potentially foods for health. But as undergraduates, they get to have a very, very vast conversation where every semester is really quite different. And hopefully they latch on to some of those concepts and can hone their journey so that they can target something they're really excited about.
Mm-hmm. So kind of along Brendan's line, working with children, what is it that you see at your level, the university, that helps people want to go even into science, let alone food science?
Yes, please tell me.
Yeah. what is it? What is it that, what motivates someone to pursue this?
Yeah, so food science is a very tangible science in that in the beginning courses, they're manipulating their food. They're understanding principles. They, depending on the class, get to taste what they produce. They get to consider different paths such as product development or food safety. And then even more broadly, how do they ensure that a safe food supply is going to be consistent for years to come? So many of our students are really gravitating towards sustainable food processing or sustainable endeavors by way of food and agriculture. And food science is a way that students can have a really big impact when they're maybe naturally strong in science capacities, or even if they are interested in chemistry, physics, biology in general, and now understand that there's a way that they can apply this to something very, very impactful, but also to something that is important for every single person on the planet every single day. Everyone needs to eat. It's right in front of us.
Yeah, I think following up with Ali and Brendan, you can corroborate that because I'm sure you teach up maybe, some of this in your classroom as well. It's when I used to teach the introduction to food science class to freshmen and other students from other degrees that were not in food science, but had to take a science class. And, it's very different. Like Ali said, well, you can see in chemistry, you're taking chemistry and you're seeing all this chemical formulas, organic chemistry, right? And you have to memorize all these bonds and hydrogen and carbon and oxygen and reactions. And it can be overwhelming. And then you kind of understand it maybe, but you don't really see how does that apply to my everyday life or my everyday well-being. But when you are in food science, then you get to see, okay, here's your carbon, your oxygen. This is what makes a carbohydrate, or this is what makes a protein. This is the chemical structure of it. And this is what it does when it interacts with this other components, with lipids or with water. And you get this reaction. Well, now you have the protein and it's reacting with this particular sugar. And now you have some browning, something that's called Maillard browning. And this is what gives this wonderful smell of roasted coffee when you're making fresh brewed coffee or when you're toasting bread in your toaster. And that smell of toast, that's Maillard browning. So when they actually are like, okay, they can do the reaction in the lab, in the food chemistry lab, and then they actually, they're toasting bread the next morning and they're like, oh, here it is. This is Maillard browning. I'm actually seeing it happen in front of my eyes. So you can actually see it. You can actually see your science and eat it and try it. I don't know, Brendan, if you have any examples that you do in class like that.
No, you're exactly right. The working with middle school students, as I do so often, the question they're asking, and they should be asking, and that I love that they ask, is like, so why does this matter? Or like, how does this show up to my life? Like, how does this matter to me? And I love that you keep calling like food science this like tangible, like intersectional science, because that's exactly what appeals to them so much. And also something that you brought up as well, Ali, this idea of what are the greater implications of food? So something that my students and young people are so often motivated by is like justice and like food justice. And what does it look like to bring better, more nutritious food to more people? And that's a really motivating factor for my students within science as well. Something we try and talk about a lot, something that they are always asking me is so why does this matter? How can this help people? What can we do with this information?
I'm going to interrupt to tell you that I have chills, actually. So hearing that that is coming out of the mouths of, you said, eighth graders,
yeah,
that is unbelievable. It is believable. It's really important that these students have these ambitions and are asking these big questions. Mm-hmm. And they give me so much hope that I have chills all over my body. And I want to work with these students. And there's lots of ways that they can have an impact, but food science is a pretty cool way that they can move in that direction. So Brendan, I think we should get together and see how we can students.
Yeah, I'd love to bring my students. I'd love to spend more time together. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, my question was going to be, and you guys are really honing in on it, which is, how does somebody even know that food science is an option? You know, we think of physics and chemistry and we kind of know the jobs like at Lilly or whatever, but I don't think too many people know that you could go into the field of science with your chemistry and stuff and actually go somewhere and study food. I mean, and be on the edge, like Brendan said, of sustainability and human justice issues.
No, I think you're right. I don't think my students often know about it. I think I didn't know that food science was a thing really, even through most of, like, before becoming a teacher and doing that program, I was in culinary school, and my culinary school was introducing a food science program just as I was ending my time there. And I think that's kind of when I heard about it for the first time. And so then, like, I love food and I'm able to talk about it in the classroom, and it's a great example of all of these things. It's probably my go-to example for most things that I talk about. But you're right. I don't think my students, definitely at the middle school or even going into the high school level, have a lot of experience there.
We have a really popular class at Purdue called Wine Appreciation. Yeah. Imagine you need to be 21, and that is typically the senior year of students. And that is when we have so many people say, oh my gosh, I wish I knew food science existed before. No, I was in my final year. So we do have a lot of stories to tell. And I think it can gravitate with a really large population of people that can find a way in and connect with something that they're passionate about. Brendan, I went the other direction. I did food science first and then went to culinary school after. And what I found in culinary school in my program, I was able to answer the, well, why is this happening? And what is really going on behind the scenes so that I can really quickly troubleshoot or maybe avoid the situation or stimulate the situation altogether. I really enjoyed the combination. And a lot of people assume that those two realms are very overlapping. And I would say that as a food scientist, you may or may not have an interest in culinary arts or even delicious food. You may be in it for the sake of food safety or food engineering, have very different perspective. But for people that really like to push the science and are culinary minded, doing a combination is great. I just stepped out of a class called Experimental Cuisine that, in my opinion, perfectly meshes those two realms together. And we wait until students are seniors because they've already had a course in food chemistry and then many other introductory courses, including food safety, where they can step into my class, Experimental Cuisine, and lead with their chemistry knowledge. But now we get to help them taste through their foods and plate foods. We even take the liberty to bring them to different parts of campus or even off campus to understand what food grows really well in our climate and other things that we are able to support within the College of Agriculture to kind of connect all those dots.
I think also the Food Network and, you know, channels like that on TV started highlighting a little bit more of that science of food, especially like, you know, like a decade ago or, you know, 20 years ago when all this molecular gastronomy boom hit all the TV channels and we had all these amazing dishes where you have the spheres that you burst and the flavors come out and they have all this you know, chemistry involved in creating these amazing foods through the molecular manipulation of the actual food ingredients. I think some of these channels allowed for those foodies and those passionate about food and making novel things get interested or a little bit of peaked into, okay, what is food science or how can I explore this a little bit further?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, what you're talking about too, you've been talking a little bit about the idea of food safety, but it really goes in two directions. It's the safety of the food that how we process and manufacture what we have. But I love this other side, which is you're going to be experimenting. I mean, experimental food is something that we do, whether mm-hmm. you know, through chefs do all the time, but it can also be dangerous. And so one of the things is mm-hmm. to have a good science base there, because you have to be really careful what you serve and with what. Because there are interactions in the chemistry between different things that people really may not think about.
Yeah. Yeah. When I used to teach the introduction to food science class, that was, it's called FS-161. And like I said, we had all our like food science freshmen had to take it. But then we had, like Ali had mentioned, we had the seniors from other programs that were on their last year and they had to take their science credit. And they would be like, again, why didn't I know about food science until now? You know, I love this class or I'm learning so much. I wish I could have switched degrees. But one of the things we used to do in the class was precisely debunk all these myths and truths surrounding food, something related to food science, whether it was food additives, GMOs, biotechnology, Frankenfoods, and we would talk about it and you know, I would show them, no, these are the facts. This is what it is. Like, you know, biotechnology is like fermentation, like beer, making bread. Well, that's involving biotechnology. It's just part of the umbrella, right? Of the bigger term. And it was really interesting for them too. And then I would make them read the labels behind, you know, different foods, and they would bring labels to class and say, what is this ingredient? And I say, okay, well, this is just a chemical name for vitamin B, or, you know, it's, so don't get alarmed. This is just like, you know, or this is just like ascorbic acid. Well, this is your vitamin C and things like that. And they would start like being more conscious of, okay, not being manipulated, what's out there, sensational media, and actually understand the facts. And no, okay, as a, you know, I would say, like, it's like if you know, just because I drive a car and I go over a bridge every day, it does not mean I'm an engineer and I can tell them how they should be, you know, building bridges. Well, the same thing happens with food science. Just because everyone eats food, then you have all these bloggers and people that have their YouTube channels or you know, or blogs that talk about, you know, additives and all these concepts related to food science that. But they don't have a degree in food science. And I'm like, I don't think you should be saying that. It's incorrect. So teaching the students the truth and the facts really helped as well.
That's great. I think all of you, but particularly in this case, Brendan, you know, I think what you were saying, Andrea, is true, that because everybody went to school, they all think they know how to teach. And so I can say that as a former teacher, I know that many of my parents thought they knew how to teach more than I did. And so it is an interesting thing. And it's true about that. And we have a lot of people that hawk, you know, certain ideas, and I'm sure they make them their way into the classroom, Brendan, as well.
Yeah. I love that you brought up biotechnology a moment ago. That's I think people should be thinking about, I think we all do, you should be thinking about what's in your food, and you should be mm-hmm. Thinking critically about the food chains and like processes that are introduced. But this idea of biotechnology and genetically modified foods, it comes into the classroom a lot during any biology unit. Before coming to teach at the school I'm at right now, I had the good fortune of working at the Children's Museum in the Biotechnology Learning Center there. And got to do a lot of exactly that, like debunking what does it mean for a food to actually be genetically modified. What's the history of that? How long has it been going on? What is the actual work that's done, and in what ways has it helped our food sources so much over time? Mm-hmm. I'm being able to do that work there, and then this work in the classroom. I love it so much. I love helping my students really understand what are these terms, what does organic actually mean? And helping through all of those things, because they are fed so much information from media, from their parents, from families, from each other. And I want them to be able to understand that and be scientifically literate as they continue to move through education.
So Brendan, when your students, all of them, when they come through food science in 4 years or so, we have an assignment in our seminar classes that is freshman through senior called Recurring Food in the Media. And they are tasked to find an article from the last few weeks of something that's happening in the food sphere. And then we talk through it a little bit about, is the source credible? Is the information credible? But it's really interesting to see where these students gravitate towards in terms of topic, but also information sourcing. So your students are gonna have a jump start in that assignment. Tell them to keep paying attention into what they're seeing in the media, what they're seeing in the news, and then eventually scientific journals, and they'll be able to mesh that all together.
Yeah, I think we've done, I think because it was easier to test on, but I think we've done science education a bad thing along the way, which was to focus on scientific method. And because you can learn these steps, but, as we all know, their methods are different depending on the science and what you're doing. There is no one universal thing that scientists do, and you make leaps. But it all begins with and all starts with what you're all talking about. And Brendan, I'm so excited about what you do in teaching, because it is all about getting them to question. Mm-hmm.
To generate their hypothesis, right?
Correct. And after that, whether you go through an experiment or you jump around, it really matters not. And there are leaps that scientists make all the time. And I think we do it a disservice in education when we boil it down to the scientific method. By the time I get students at Butler, where I teach urban ecology, I get the same problem where they come in and they've got the whole method down. And I'm going, wait. it doesn't work like that. It's not that boring. Yeah. And so I think that's really good. I think the other is you're talking a lot about media literacy and being able to pass that on even to your students at Purdue. And it is really hard today, because I think many of our listeners don't realize that because of the way of technology, Andrea could be presenting something at a conference coming up that is not proven yet. It's just some of her findings. And it's going to be presented and then peer reviewed. But that can be picked up if it gets into the internet by a bot that is trolling, looking for that. And it can become a number news story in a magazine without any verification, ever talking to you, without ever knowing if it's a real, what the results were. Can be totally misinterpreted. So mm-hmm. I think that's how we get so much misinformation. Plus we get disinformation, which is from people that have something that an agenda they want. And so they purposely put out information about food, like you're saying with GMOs. We've been modifying things for a very long time. What's it mean to be GMO? And so, which I do have a question for all of you, one that always gets to me. And that is, what does it mean to be all natural artificial? Because I see that on labels all the time.
I know.
What is natural artificial?
You mean in the same sentence?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's all natural artificial.
I've never seen that.
Oh no.
It's an oxymoron. Well, or what it's like, even like that, what is all natural? Like,
They must be making something artificially in the lab to add to it that's made out of natural ingredients is all I can.
I would assume that it was something not naturally present in that environment that was natural somewhere else, but was added blue raspberry applesauce or something like that.
That's wow. Anyway, my one big question of the day. We've been talking with Andrea Lysiega, Brendan Chandler, and Allie Kingley about the aesthetics and the science of food, including ways to improve taste, nutrition, and health through art and science. You can join us for more conversation after this break.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with Andrea Lysiega, Brendan Chandler, and Allie Kingery about the aesthetics and science of food. But before the break, we early on in the last segment, we were talking about the idea of what it means to really have sustainability, equity, and being able to look at justice issues for food justice. And those are big, big questions that all of us are going to have to deal with. Sustainability into the future is an issue, whether we'll have enough food to sustain a growing population. But also currently, even in the United States, who gets food? Who gets what quality of food? At what cost? Those are all things I think that we ought to explore. Somebody want to dive into any of that?
Go, Brendan. Maybe start by giving us some of the conversations you have with the students regarding that topic. Since it was so amazing that they brought it up.
Sure. So my students that I've had, now students I've had in the past, spend a lot of time thinking about food justice and everything from food deserts and how could we potentially use agriculture and growing techniques or different methods of distribution to help solve the issues of food deserts here in the United States and around the world. They have a pretty strong understanding of climate and biomes and get curious about how, when those things start to shift as a result of climate change, what's that going to do to agriculture and what's that going to do to food supplies as that starts to shift as well. And then when I've had students who have started to understand a bit about biotechnology and genetically modified foods, wanting to find ways to create more nutritious or faster growing or shorter crop cycle foods a la dwarf wheat or beta carotene and rice, things like that. They want more ways to be able to do that and want to be able to do that themselves in the future, or want science to spend more time focusing on that. Those are questions they've asked before and things that they're curious about and want to be able to do in the future.
Those are great.
When I was a student, I graduated from food science in 2009. The message that I received, now it doesn't necessarily mean that's the message that was given, but the message that I received was, if you're interested in saving the world, then that's by way of working in another continent to help this move the needle forward. And it is this big lofty idea, and it felt like there were so many roadblocks as somebody entering the workforce to be able to solve those big problems of food security. And now students are weaving it into their interests before they even get here. And they're like, okay, I'm here for food science and I am ready for the coursework, but this is what I want to do with it. And these students are starting to vocalize that when they are on they're interviewing for internships or interacting with alums. This message is really shifting to, okay, I don't want this to be just a pie in the sky, slim chance I'll ever get here. This needs to be part of my journey from the beginning. So they're looking for companies that support that initiative and are driving that change. And that is what so many students, in fact, 90% of our incoming freshmen this year raised their hand when we asked them who is intending to find a sustainable, a career path that involves sustainability in food science. 90% of them have that intention as freshmen right now. So we're telling our industry connections that, listen, these guys are coming and this is what they want to do. So your company can highlight some of the things you're already doing, or you might lose out on this upcoming generation of food scientists that are really looking to make a sustainable difference. And it's not just sustainability on the other side of the world, it's sustainability here.
And I think adding into that, so Brandon's talking about students now in grade eight, and Ali talked about her own experience as when she was an undergrad or a freshman. I get to experience them as senior students as well when I teach their last sort of culmination class, which is the product development, the capstone class that they take in their senior year, where they have to, as the name implies, develop a product using all the knowledge that they have acquired over the past 4 years as undergraduate food science students. So since I took over that class last year, I sort of switched the gears a little bit on, okay, yes, you're going to develop a product. We're going to focus at lab scale, perhaps. We're not going to try and make it pilot scale, but I want you to develop a food product with the term sustainability in mind, like all the way from what ingredients are used outsourcing and the type of packaging that you're going to use as well. Like, I don't want the plastics. I don't want the styrofoam. What are you going to use, or how are you going to minimize the packaging? And they're really excited about that. And they're really looking at, or, you know, and I also obviously emphasize the healthy aspects of the food. So I don't want a food product that it's going to be full of sugar, super sweet. And, you know, like, be conscious of what you're, as a food scientist, you have a big responsibility to ethically produce food that is going to feed, you know, your peers, but that it's also, that it's healthy, that it's safe, that it's nutritious, but also that it's perhaps sustainable and that it's environmentally friendly, in terms that you're not going to be producing all this packaging and all this plastic, excess plastic that we don't need anymore. And so they really take that into account, and it gets them really excited about the products that they're making, because I'm not imposing them the ingredients, but I'm just giving them the topic and ethically how, you know, to graduate as a food scientist, you need to have this in the back of your mind all the time, that is this what I'm doing ethically? Is this sustainable? How is this going to impact the planet? It's not just making money in the company, but how, what's the implications it's going to have for future generations as well?
Yeah, those are all amazing, because you can see the progression on up through education, and it starts. And we, what I like is, I don't always like the idea that we wait and we push everything down, that it should start with little kids because they're going to change the world. What I like about this is that it's reinforcing all along. And so I wish we had something for adults that was continuing ed that would do the same thing. They're not going to be a food scientist, but they do something. And what I think is powerful here is the idea of intervening with what people think are their assumptions about what's happening with food or not happening with it. You brought up food desert, which I think is really interesting. And there's a lot of misunderstanding as to what we mean by that, because people go, hey, there's food, you know, nearby. But what do we mean when we say a food desert?
So I, I don't claim to be an expert in this realm at all, but my understanding of a food desert is that it is a an area in which people don't have a grocery store that provides foods, and particularly not like processed foods, but have access to like fresh foods like in a given area. So like so often here in cities, I know it's definitely here in Indianapolis, we end up with giant grocery stores across the street from each other in the suburbs. But moving into the inner city, there's not a lot of access to full grocery stores. Again, ones that provide fresh food. A lot of food sources at that point become things like Dollar General and like convenience stores.
Right.
Instead of giving full access for people to make choices, to find new nutritious foods. It's just really, really limiting. That's my understanding. That's the definition I've worked with before, but not.
Yeah. And I think you're right, Brenda. And there's also a walking, the amount of distance that I have to go,
thank you.
Assuming I don't have either transportation or whatever. But it's the healthy, what you got, it, exactly, I think the way I understand it as well is what's healthy.
And I would argue that, or interject that, a lot of the perception of food science is only the shelf stable, highly processed, heavy sugar, heavy sodium products that I always tell prospective students, as long as there's a demand for that, companies will still be producing, and we still need to make them safely. But food science can be so much broader than those products. And if you are turned off by, or have the luxury of not needing to rely on those heavily processed foods, that doesn't mean your opportunities with food science are over. There are so many different ways that you can step in and support the food industry and feed yourself, your family, your peers, your community.
Yeah, you know, I think people get surprised. And Brendan, you were mentioning going out of Indianapolis into the suburbs. The shopping experience is completely, completely different. I mean, I can go to the same Kroger store in one or the other and find a completely different product in terms of what's there. The cost may actually not be less, which is an interesting thing. It may be, you know, a much older product, or it may be something. And I think one of the things that is hard here is how do we cut across to getting to where we say that having good food for people, and yes, it can be culturally different, what's in different places, but what I mean is, but having the best quality food for all people, I think is really important. We're starting to get that way, by the way, with food pantries, where we said just canned goods, you know, and processed goods is not necessarily healthy. And so we were trying to figure out how to get around that. And so there are more sources of fresh things that are going to there, but it is a challenge. How much, when you guys both are working at Purdue, how much do your students, because Ali, you were saying they come in now kind of with an interest on not only the sustainability, but also concerns that they have. How much does that start to change your program a little bit as well?
That's a great question that we've spent the last several years addressing. How do we reflect the student drive? How do we continue to connect with them in our courses? And Andrea, you can help me with this. I think over time, our core courses have stayed put. There's certainly still a need for students to understand food chemistry, food processing, food safety, foods for health, but our examples can evolve. And the way that we talk about how this applies, why is this important? Like Brendan was saying, how does this impact me? Those questions that eighth graders are asking are what we're trying to address by way of, I think, communicating across faculty that this is what the students are really gravitating with. Now, of course, research projects will shift and evolve. Product development competitions will emerge, and we encourage students to layer in their core foundation with their interests in lots of different ways.
Yeah, and adding to what Ali said, I think that, yeah, definitely our core curriculum classes, like the core chemistries, the core sciences have to stay the same because they need to know the concepts first before they can make modifications or look forward to evolving, right, the sciences. But the examples, like Ali said, have changed. But also for us, like we even as a department, I think we've actually now hired other faculty members that bring newer, a different perspective or add in to the expertise that we already have for teaching. So for example, we have a faculty member whose expertise is he's well known for doing life cycle analysis of all the different processing, a food that we have. So if we wanted to like to make cheese or to make beer, well, what's the impact that how much water are we using? How much energy, how all the inputs that are needed to make, a gallon of milk. Well, how can we work with a life cycle analysis to decrease maybe the inputs of all those inputs so that it's a more sustainable process in the future? And then we are not causing such detrimental effects on the planet. So having this new faculty member now bringing that expertise and having him in this case, it's a male instructor, teach this classes or this knowledge to the students, incorporate that into our food processing classes, then that we're already then, going ahead with the evolving demand by students as well.
When you construct your course and you're thinking about some of the issues are, what are all the hidden costs in sustainability? For instance, I know that California is one of the almond capitals of the world, but almonds are incredibly water intensive and we're shipping more water than we are anything else, but we don't charge for that water. Yeah. It goes somewhere else on the planet away from California. And then we also have transportation costs, the fuel costs, and the farther something has to go, and the more hands it has to change, are you teaching that kind of sustainability as well?
Yeah, in a way we are. And I think also making them aware that, yeah, you may be thinking you're eating, like you said, we're eating, trying to eat all this or be more sustainable, but here we are drinking all this almond milk and all this because we are not, not that we're against the dairy, but, the consumers that want to shift from their animal protein sources like dairy foods into a more plant-based diet. So I'm like, yeah, well, is that almond milk even more sustainable, really, when you factor in all those costs? But I think that's where another cool aspect of food science can come in, right? Like we were talking about technology. How can we make those almonds maybe require less water? What can we do to those plants to have them require less water, less inputs, but they can still have a good quality output? And I think that's where the future of the science is going to go towards as well.
I love that. I mean, I love thinking about all those ideas. Mm-hmm. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others any of the ideas we're exploring in today's show, and we'll be right back.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about the aesthetics and science of food, including ways to improve taste, nutrition, and health through art and science. Speaking of art and science, I have two chefs with me as well. And Andrea, I know that a part of your research is really around, does it look good? Does it taste good?
Yes.
Those kinds of things. And so I really want to explore the art part of food for a little bit, this last segment. So Brendan, what is the difference between a cook and a chef? And I think there really is a difference.
Oh, good question. I would say that I think there are maybe several different additions, but like functionally, like I would call a cook someone who maybe spends time doing the work of cooking for others at home or just within their own smaller community. I think chef is often a term, at least classically, that's reserved for people who do the work professionally in a restaurant. I think those definitions might break down at some point. If you've got the training from, you know, growing up with your family and in your own home, is that always really all that different from what you get in culinary school? Well, yeah, but you're still learning the process. So I think they break down at some point, but classically I would say a chef is someone who does the work professionally and a cook is someone who
wouldn't you say that I think one of the differences, the cook generally, I know they can be blended and they can create, but the chef is the more of the artist often.
Yes. Yes. So then like within the restaurant, you have your whole classic brigade system, right? With your chef de cuisine and your sous chefs, and then your assorted line cooks. So then that word chef, even within the professional industry, gets reserved for some and
not others.
Yeah. There's a lot that could be unpacked with.
But I think the important thing here is that in all of those, you know, when you start a restaurant and you're, you know, it gets a signature. If they're all the same, it's different. But if you start one, it gets a signature. It's often from the artistic signature, right down to not only the taste, but it's the whole presentation, which gets to what Andrea researches sometimes. So the whole way, you know, I used to, when my mom was in the nursing home, I would go and who would want to have everything brown and yellow? You know, I mean, come on, people. And that's, you know, that was how they institutionally, I mean, no wonder people wouldn't want to eat. You know, if a bland diet means all browns and yellows, then we've got something wrong. We can be more creative than that, right? I mean, so.
Absolutely.
Allie, how does that affect, I mean, you were in a chef and now you've moved it into what you're doing now.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of intersection, if you want there to be, between the culinary arts and food science. Again, specifically, I think that that food science is relying more and more and more on chefs to help steer the ship in meeting consumer demand. So that can be at a single restaurant. There are still food science elements intertwined with food safety, food processing, food chemistry. Dr. Lisiaga's Maillard Browning reaction that comes in the restaurant. But as a food scientist, we rely on chefs, research chefs, corporate chefs to really help emphasize flavor profiles and creating products that consumers are going to come back for again and again. So it's really this immersive conversation where the culinary minded folks are part of the conversation, I think, much more early on in this element of getting food to the people.
Andrea, when you're researching, what, I know this is right up your line. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead. No, finish up,
Mark. Now, what I was going to ask you was, you know, you also look at, in the food science thing, how different things affect, you know, the texture, the color, those things. You were talking about, you know, decreasing water in an almond, but you have to then be aware of the issues. Does it taste better or does it taste worse or does it, you know, so you can't just engineer it. You also have, because we're dealing with somebody's perception of taste.
Yes. And before I answer, I just have to add to the two chefs on the show that for me also, when I see chefs and I know about their profession, for me, like it's admiration too, because in a way they're artists, just like we have our artists that paint beautiful paintings, you know, throughout centuries. I think a chef has that ability of getting the most simple ingredients that you could think of and create a work of art with that. And that is something that you can't just learn in school, but also it's something you have. It's a, what do you call it when you're born with that, a talent, right? Not everyone can be a chef. It's an artist inside of them that creates these beautiful works of art with food. but with what I do in terms of the science of sensory evaluation, or is precisely, we look at, okay, we can have very nutritious food or very sustainable food, but how at the end of the day is how, what does it look like? What does it smell like? And what does it taste like? And if consumers are not happy with the appearance, they're not even gonna smell it. Or if they like the appearance, but they smell it and they don't like the aroma of that food, they're not gonna be willing to try it. But let's say that the appearance and the aroma are checked, they like them when they put that food in their mouth. If they don't like the flavor, the taste, or the texture, especially texture, which is can be very people, that's what we're more finicky about as humans. We texture is, it's probably a sensory attribute that really puts us off food. If we don't like any of that, then we will not eat it, no matter how healthy it is, how nutritious it is, how good for the planet it is. But on that same note, we know as sensory scientists, we know that with the topic of sustainability, we know that the claims, what we call the utilitarian claims, which are all those claims related to sustainability, good for the environment, they can switch consumers' perceptions and acceptance of food. But at the end of the day, that, you know, that can go so far. At the end of the day, the other, you know, maybe halfway through, but the other 50% of that road to accepting that particular food or a change in our diet and our behavior towards food is going to be exclusively related to the hedonics, to whether we like it or dislike that food product, how it tastes, how it smells, and how much we enjoy eating it. So that's definitely a very important aspect of it as well.
Yeah, and I've been doing more on my own of some plant-based shift a little bit to it, not completely, because there's still things I think are more sustainable, like we were talking with milk or cheese or some of those are important. But my big thing when I do it was, you know, I think I used to laugh and say, well, why would anybody want to make it look like something that's meat? However, you know, some of the new burgers are amazing. The texture's there, the flavor's there, it's kind of smoky. They're amazingly close to giving you what it is, but you feel totally different because you don't really have that huge fat content a lot of times. So, you know, I think you're making, I mean, in what you're doing, you and food scientists for what you're doing, is you really are beginning to engineer some things to have many of the qualities that we would like that move us along that healthier thing.
It's super important. And I know a lot of these new companies that are coming out with all these meat analogs or dairy analogs, you know, if you go into their websites, you can see that their market is not vegans or vegetarians. They're actually going through their market. Their target market are the meat consumers, the dairy consumers. And the reason and that they want us to switch our preferences is because, you know, being more humane with our surrounding, with the animals that provide us food. I mean, that's from what I've seen in some of these websites for these companies. So maybe it's not, they may not be as, you know, sustainability is a big one, but also that animal well-being of being more empathetic to the animals that, you know, that we eat. So switching our diet to plant-based, being more protective of the environment, but also of the animals. So again, if they don't make, but that's why they are trying to make those analogs resemble and taste exactly like the dairy products or the meat products that we're accustomed to, because that's their market.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what, why it's so important that the work you're doing, because I think you hit it earlier, and that was that we won't eat.
Yeah. No matter.
No matter what. I mean, we can make it a few converts, but not very many people.
Yeah.
Why when veganism first came in, I was like, there's no way that I'm going to go, it looked bland. It looked, awful. And now it's so different. Brendan and Allie, I think, the creativity that somebody when they go to culinary school, and it's called culinary arts usually, there is got to be something said for all that. So you've got to be looking at not just the safe preparation of food and that, but you got to be looking at other stuff. So what else do you get in your training that helps you to be, what's the package look like on the art side?
My favorite element of culinary school was understanding flavor profiles. I really liked my international cuisine class because I learned about pairings that were not obvious to me and can get misinterpreted in a Google recipe search. I liked building that foundation of flavor profiles that match different cuisines. That was my favorite part that I didn't naturally obtain in food science. There wasn't room for that conversation in food science, but in culinary school, I really loved that part.
I 100% agree. I have something very similar to say. We were talking about like food and how there absolutely is an art aspect to it. And what I love about art is what I love about food. When I like see something new or experiencing something new, when I'm forced to think about something or try something in a different way. And that's what exactly my international cuisines classes got me to do when we cooked our way through Southeast Asia and when we cooked our way through Northern Africa, being able to try new ingredients, things I'd never had before, and figure out ways to use those ingredients both classically and historically, and then be able to find ways to try and incorporate those ingredients into food that I had more experience with, was absolutely the best part of my culinary training as well. There's a reason I ended up as a science teacher. The actual like visual aesthetics of food is a lot more challenging for me. I failed my cake decorating practical, failed so hard. The work of creating new and interesting flavor profiles was absolutely the best part of that experience.
And my last plug for prospective students that are interested in merging the two areas, food science and culinary, or even for people that are trying to decide one way or the other, there's so much need for creativity in a scientist portfolio. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And those don't always come together. I've really had to push myself in culinary school. And in fact, that's why I did it after food science, because I didn't understand how to push up against the constructs. I just didn't have that coding yet. So food science, culinary arts helped me layer that into food science and layer into a lot of different facets of my life to push those creativity buttons that I was always too scared to push before.
That's really a great summary, Allie. I want to thank Andrea, Brendan, and Allie for helping us explore the science and art of food and healthy eating. You'll find pictures of some of the things we've talked about today, as well as other guests, on the DaVinciPursuit.com, where we create museums without walls, so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations. Until then, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.